Today's Taisho will be on Case 61 in the Book of Serenity. Case 61 is entitled John Fong's One. Introduction. A roundabout explanation is easy to understand. It imparts with one hand. A direct explanation is hard to understand. It opens up in all directions. I urge you not to use clear speech, for if speech is clear, getting out is all the more difficult. If you don't believe, let's try to bring this up. A monk asked Jian Feng, "The blessed ones of the ten directions are on one road, the gate of nirvana. Where is that road?" Jian Feng drew a line in the air with his staff and said, "It is here." The monk asked Yunmen the same question. Yunmen said, "The fan leaps up to the 33 heavens and hits the emperor of the gods on the nose. The carp of the eastern sea is hit once with the stick, and it rains buckets. Do you understand? Do you understand?" Verse. Starting in, it turns out he uses medicine for a dead horse. The reviving incense is about to cause you peril. If all your life you squeeze out sweat through your body, only then will you believe he didn't spare his eyebrows. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen today. This morning was a beautiful morning. And in the Zendo, everybody was sitting so still. You know, our practice is to sit for relatively long periods of time. So we have, after sutra recitation, we have three periods of meditation. And many people sit through all three periods or take a very brief break. Then we get up and we go to the bathroom, and then we come back and we do two more periods of meditation without any break. And that's really quite unusual. You know, a few years ago, Earl and Lenore, Lenore wasn't able to be here today, but Earl and Lenore were in, I think it was somewhere in California. And they went to a temple where there was a Roshi, Japanese Roshi there. And he wasn't sure he was going to let them sit with his community. And he said, How long do you generally sit?" He was expecting them to say 25 minutes or something like that. And they said, "Well, we sometimes sit for an hour and a half." And the teacher said, "Oh, please come right in." So, you know, it's easy if you have been practicing Zen for a while not to appreciate how deeply you get into samadhi. Even if it feels as though your mind is full of thoughts, you know, for people to sit still for three periods of meditation or two for an hour and a half or an hour shows really deep concentration, really deep. At the end of each period of sitting, you know, the last period of sitting in each set, I before I ring the bell, I look around to see where people are, and everybody was sitting so still just before I rang the bell at 9:35, at 10:35. Very still, excellent practice. That's really worth a lot. You know, you've practiced a lot to be able to get into that deep state. Please keep cultivating your Buddha minds. So this is an interesting koan because it begins with a bit of a warning. The introduction says, a roundabout explanation is easy to understand. It imparts with one hand. A direct explanation is hard to understand. A roundabout explanation is easy. A direct explanation is actually hard to understand. It opens up in all dimensions. He says, I urge you not to use clear speech. For if speech is clear, getting out is more difficult. So that's an interesting statement. He says, don't be clear. You know, you may wonder if you've had a chance to read some of the Mahayana sutras. They're far from clear. A couple people in our group have been reading the sutras, and I urge you to do it. I would start with the Diamond Sutra, read the Heart Sutra. Stan has been reading the Lankavatara Sutra, which is the Sutra Dhammo, Bodhidharma, brought from India to China when he brought Chan, when he brought Zen. And if you try to read these sutras, they're very difficult. Some of you may know Egbert, who is not here this morning, but who sits up in North Jersey and comes to Sesshin. He comes to every Sesshin. He wanted to read the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. And I said, oh, that's so exciting. Please read the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra. And he said, I can't understand one sentence of this. Now, Egbert is a mathematician and an engineer. He likes things imparted with one hand, right? You might think, why didn't the authors of these sutras just write plainly what they want to say? See? But they didn't. They made it confusing. Why would they do this? Why would they do this? You know, I'm an English professor and I teach writing. And I will say to my students, this is not clear. I don't know what you mean. Please make your ideas more clear. But here, the instruction is, whatever you do, don't be clear. Right? And that's very strange. And then we get two masters ask the same question. A monk asked Jianfeng, the blessed ones in the 10 directions are on one road, the gate of nirvana. Where is that road? And Jianfeng drew a line in the air with his staff and said, right here. It's right here. See? Now, we all get that, right? We all understand that. If you've read books on Zen or if you've practiced Zen for a while, you know, everybody says, you know, really all you need to wake up is right here. This very moment is it, right? This very moment is it. So the blessed ones are of the 10 directions are on one road, the gate of nirvana. Where is that road? He says, right here. See, right where you find yourself is the road to nirvana. And, you know, when we hear that, we note it approvingly, right? We say, of course, you know, that's Zen teaching. Enlightenment isn't up in heaven. It's right here now, right? Haven't we heard that a million times? But is that really good advice or not? Did Jianfeng do the right thing? Because in the introduction it says, whatever you do, don't be clear. If you're clear, you're misleading people. See? And the monk asked this question, and Jianfeng's answer couldn't be clearer, right? Couldn't be clearer. So now the monk goes on to Yunmen, the cloud gate, and he asks the same question. He says, the blessed ones of the 10 directions are on one road, the gate of nirvana. Where is that road? And Yunmen says, the fan leaps up to the 33 heavens and hits the emperor of the gods on the nose. The carp of the eastern sea is hit once with the stick and it rains buckets. Do you understand? Do you understand? Of course you don't understand. Because it's totally unclear. Like so much of Zen discourse. So unclear. So the question is, who gave the right answer here? See. Now, this is a really important issue. I don't know if you've seen the movie. You probably have. In fact, this movie is probably old enough that I don't know if you've seen it or not. But it's called Castaway with Tom Hanks. I saw that movie, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, something like that. But maybe 11 years ago, I can't even remember. But I was cleaning up the house, and I couldn't stand to clean the house anymore. So I sat down, and I was listening to some music, and on my YouTube, and it produced the theme song to Castaway. And when I listened to the theme song, I remembered the movie, and I thought, "Oh, that was such a beautiful movie." And I went to Netflix, and between cleaning, I was rewatching the movie, which is actually a wonderful movie. If you haven't seen the movie, it's about a guy who is a UPS person, and he's all set to get married. He's in a relationship with Helen Hunt, you might know her, and Tom Hanks is the lead. So Tom Hanks is working for UPS, and his fiance is Helen Hunt, and their lives are just about to begin. And he's involved in shipping some packages across the Pacific. So he's on a plane, and they've got he's supervising the transit of these passages on the plane. And basically, there's an accident. Something goes wrong. And the plane actually, I think it crashes, right? And it's in the middle of the South Pacific. And miraculously, Tom Hanks washes up on this island. And everybody else on the plane is dead. In fact, he finds the dead bodies of some of his colleagues. He has to survive on this island as a modern person. Excuse me. He's basically trying to figure out how to survive on this little Pacific island. And he has a few packages. He gathers up a few of the packages he was going to deliver, and the packages contain various things, a pair of ice skates that he realizes he can use to make an axe out of, and sneakers because he doesn't his feet are burning from the hot sand. And at any rate, the movie is so interesting because he's all alone on this island. And he's totally lost. He can see, at one moment, he sees a light on the horizon. It must be a ship in transit. And he tries lighting up some debris, and he writes a big help in the sand. And he's there for years. And he has the usual modern person's resources. So he has to try to fish. He has to try to find water. And in all of these, he's completely incompetent. Anyway, I won't take you through every step of the movie, which is excruciating, I know. The point is, he finally gets off the island and is rescued. He builds a raft. He gets free from the island, and he almost dies. And he's picked up by a cargo ship and taken back to his old life, right? And everything is that he had in the past has changed, right? So his fiance has now married someone else. And I believe they have a child. She's gone on with her life, Basically, his business friends are really happy to see him, and they throw him a party, but he can't get back into his old life. You know, he can't go back to UPS and start working in his old job, even though they want him to. And his relationship with his fiance is over, even though he'd like it to be, he could like to pick up where he left off. He can't. And so it's very poignant, in my opinion. You know, he went on this, he was isolated on this island by himself for years. And in the process of being alone, he's totally transformed. You know, at first he's sort of a typical one of us. You know, he eats three meals a day, he drives a car to work, he might get a little exercise on the weekend. You know, at the end of the movie, he's been living on the land. You know, he's in incredible physical shape. He's eaten fish and, vegetables for 3 years or something. He's got long, matted hair. You know, he's totally different. He's able to, deal with all of these emergencies very calmly. And he's been able to fish and gather water and, you know, survive. So now he's back in civilization, and, you know, they have a party, and he looks at all this food, the table after the party, the celebration for him. There's all this food, and he looks at all the food. You know, this is more food than he's had to eat in 3 years, you know, and it's all just sitting there wasted, right? And he can't go back to his old life. And I think this is really poignant. You know, the ending of the movie is quite interesting because he's actually delivering some of the packages that were on that plane. And he's out in the middle of nowhere, out in Texas, you know. And it's absolutely flat and dry in all directions. And he's at a crossroads. And he's trying to find this location. And this woman drives up in a truck, pickup truck, and asks him if he needs directions. And anyway, she offers him, she tells him where he is, and where, you know, this is, Amarillo's in this direction, California's in that direction, Canada's in that direction. She gets back into her truck and she drives up. Obviously, she's going to some farm on this country road where she lives. And he notices on the back of her truck an emblem, these wings. And the emblem was on one of the packages he was supposed to deliver. So, you know, the movie stops there with him looking at the, he realizes, wait a minute, those wings were on the package I was delivering, and he has the package in his car. So there's like a karmic connection. See, this is a romance that's supposed to start in just a few moments, but the movie is over. See. Now, you know, it's a movie, right? So we can't expect too much from it. But, you know, as somebody who's practiced Zen for 40 years, when I look at it, I think, oh, this is all about Zen. Right. You could say that he was living a conventional life. You know, he was doing what he was supposed to do with his life. He got a job with UPS. He had a security badge pinned to his shirt. You know, he was buying a house. He probably bought a wedding ring on the installment plan, as we used to say, on credit. You know, his life was all set. And then this amazing thing happens that rips him out of his life, and he's alone by himself on this island. And, you know, he kind of discovers things about himself that he never knew. You know, he didn't know who he was. Right? He didn't know who he was. He was being what society said he should be. Right? His parents, his teachers, etc., etc. And he was torn out of all this by this accident. And suddenly he's in this, you could say, this ordeal where he has to become a different person. He has to find in himself these resources. And he does. When he comes back to his old world, it's no longer possible for him to be that person because he's a bigger person. You know, he's like the man of no rank, right? We think we must have this, you know. I must have shoes, you know. I must have yogurt for breakfast, you know. All of that is taken away from him, and he has to create his life from scratch, you know. And all the things he depended on, you know, toilet. There's no toilet paper, you know. If you get sick, there's no antibiotics. Of course, I'm very glad there are antibiotics. But, he comes back into the world of conventional life, and he doesn't belong there anymore. And he can't belong there because he doesn't look to that life for the meaning in his life anymore, right? He's in a bigger place. So, you know, the interesting thing is at the end of the movie, he's at a crossroads. You know, crossroads are a symbol like of possibility, right? Possibility. You know, he can go north, he can go south, he can go east, and he can go west. And, you know, this amazingly, this beautiful young woman drives up in her pickup truck and offers him directions. And as she's driving away, he sees this emblem of wings on the back of her truck, and we just saw that package with the wings on it, which he's been carrying around for 5 years, is in his car, right? So he's going to make a delivery to her, probably, and he's going to start a whole new life in a different life as a different person, right? So, you know, I think this is what Zen is all about. You know, I think you could say that when we sit, we're going to that island, you know. We are definitely taking ourselves out of our everyday lives, right? And we're going to a place where none of those rules really apply any longer. You know, if you've done koan training, you know what I mean. You know, in Zen practice, you know, the teacher gives you a koan. And the koans very rarely make sense. So, you know, if the teacher says, if you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. Nothing in your conventional toolkit is going to allow you to solve that koan. And the more you draw on your conventional knowledge, right, the harder it's going to become to reach some kind of resolution. You know, so koans are really being cast away on an island. You know, you have to invent your world from scratch when you're working with a koan. And this is difficult to do because people rely on common sense. They rely on the lessons they grew up with. They rely on what they learned watching TV when they were kids, right? And none of those lessons are going to work. You know, koans really ask you to reinvent the world from the ground up. They give you a contradiction, you know, contradiction. And you can't work it out unless you see things in a different way, okay? So, you know, there used to be a kind of puzzle that some of you might remember called Where's Waldo? And Where's Waldo was a drawing, usually very complicated. So it might be a scene in a jungle, and there's palm trees, and there's undergrowth, and there's rocks, and there's a tiger, and there's a monkey, and there's this and that. And you're supposed to find Waldo. There's a little picture of his face, and it's like, find this face somewhere in this picture. And you can look and look and look. And actually, the harder you look, the harder it is to find Waldo. You have to begin to develop like an ambient awareness or ambient attention. You don't fix your mind on any detail. You just let the eye wander. And all of a sudden, there's Waldo. It just leaps out at you. Once you see Waldo, you can't not see Waldo. He's right there, right? This is an unconscious process of recognizing something that's you weren't looking in the right place for, right? So this is called, in psychology, this is called a gestalt switch. It's where you're bringing one set of eyes to the situation, and then, you know, you have to develop, like, you have to see in a different way. You know, there's a famous, in psychology textbooks, there's always this famous illustration of this, where it can either be a goblet or two people kissing, right? And if you see it as a goblet, you don't see the two people kissing. And if you see it as two people kissing, it's very hard to see the goblet. All of a sudden, you see the goblet. And it's like, oh my gosh, you know. It's hard to... So you go through this gestalt switch. Well, koan training is like that too. You know, it's basically the logic of the koan is that our conceptual habits imprison us. And this is an ancient teaching that the Buddha himself very clearly passed on, right? You know, our mental habits color the world in ways that cause our suffering. So, you know, it's possible that you feel a lot of suffering right now because a madman runs the United States. And it's possible you feel a lot of suffering because, you know, they're going to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, right? But actually, that's not the cause of your suffering, according to Buddhism. And you can say, what? You know, that's crazy. But that's not, according to Buddhism, the cause of your suffering. You know, humans have always been destructive at times, there have been many crazy rulers, right? Many crazy rulers. You know, how we deal with our reality will produce suffering if our mental habits haven't been worked through. And so, you know, koan training is about working through our habitual mental habits, right? And reaching a place where we suddenly see the world in a totally different way. And, you know, the interesting thing is that nobody can do this for you. Because it's not like a Where's Waldo puzzle. You know, the Where's Waldo puzzle was manufactured in New York by people who make puzzles. And there is a Waldo there, and you have to find it, right? But with koans, actually, there isn't an answer. You have to recreate the world in a way that gets you out of your suffering, out of your mental habits. You know, so it's a little bit, to change my metaphors, you know, people put themselves in chains, right? And you have to be a little bit like Houdini, you know, you have to get out of your chains, right? And the teacher's giving you the koan, and you're struggling to get out of the chains you yourself have created. And at some point, you unlock all your chains, you know, or at some point, you recreate the world to see it in a new way. And that's really a process we go through again and again. And after a while, we realize that when we fall into suffering, when we fall into fear or anger, if we've gone through this process enough, we realize the emotions of distress that I'm feeling right now are not necessary. I'm doing this to myself, right? We begin to see our mental, the distress-producing mental habits, right? And often, if you've been doing Zen long enough, you can sit down on the cushion and see very clearly where these mental habits are coming from. So, you know, this idea of going on an island and having to reconstruct your world that was part of this movie seemed to me very Zen. You know, nobody can do this for you. Only you can untie your chains. Only you can reconstruct the world so that you can find your Waldo, you know. And no one can do it for you. The the Roshi, the teacher, is like facilitating the process, right? But only you can answer the koan. Only you can work through the koan. So, you know, the interesting thing, though, about this is that you can't, you know, I've done hundreds and hundreds of koans, and I've been doing Zen practice for 40 years. Sometimes the best thing a teacher can do is not give the student a straight answer, right? I studied with one teacher, a man named Edo Shimano, who was an incredibly talented Roshi. And Edo thought nothing of giving you, in koan practice, misdirection, right? That's the only way I could put it. You know, you go into to Dokusan with Edo Roshi, I remember giving him an answer, and he said, oh, he shook his head, and he went, tut, tut, it was like tisk, tisk. He said, that is a terrible answer. And I left thinking, oh my God, you know, what's wrong with me? You know, a terrible, that's, now he didn't just say you're a little off the mark. He said, that's a terrible answer. So, you know, I went back to my cushion, and I was in so much emotional distress, right? And I thought, you know, wait a minute. I've finished my training with Webb, you know, I have blah, 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 you know, I've had this experience, you know. How dare he tell me I gave a terrible answer, you know? And so I realized, you know, I was still in chains of my own making, right? I mean, it wounded my pride, he wounded my sense of, you know, confidence in myself, you know, and so, but the fact that these were woundable, right, shows that I wasn't really completely free of these things, right? So you know, I had to do a lot of sitting to see what he was doing. And when I realized what he was doing, it was like that devil, you know, that bastard, you know. And when I went in to see him, you know, he was actually laughing, you know. And I was laughing, you know. It was so liberating to be crossed like that or to be misled, you know. If he had said, oh, that's a very good answer, see, that's a pretty good answer. You know, he pushed me right back down on the ground, you know, and I was furious and I was hurt and all of these other things. And, you know, at some point I just had to let all that go. So, who cares? Okay, so what if I got a wrong answer? Big deal. Who cares, right? Maybe it is a terrible answer, you know? So what would be a better answer, you know, and so on. He did that to me all the time. And strangely, it was the best Zen training I ever had. Studying with him was like going to graduate school, right? Because you never knew what if he was telling you was you know, the truth or a lie, right? It was so exciting, right? You know, so it was exciting. It was like every time I would go in there, he would pull the rug out from under me, right? And after a while, I was just so, it was like the electricity was flowing through my veins. You know, I don't usually do that. That's not my style, right? To pull the rug out from under people. I really don't do that. But, you know, maybe I should do that more often, you know? Because it certainly worked with Edo Roshi. You know, I was constantly vigilant and constantly like under attack, right? You know. So he did that to me a couple times. The first time he did it, it made me so mad, you know. But I benefited greatly from his indirection, you know. So, you know, Tom Hanks had to go on this island and lose, pretty much lose all control, over his situation. And he had to remake his world, you know. And when he came back to so-called civilization, he was a different person. You know, because he wasn't, I would say he wasn't looking to society to tell him what was real anymore, right? You know, standing at the crossroads of life is a wonderful way for that movie to end. You know, he's at the crossroads. At crossroads, you can go north, you can go south, you can go east, you can go west. Which way will you go, right? And, you know, he could go in any direction. Nothing is telling him which way to go. So, you know, whichever way he chooses to go, it's really just a free choice, right? And he has to be open to the possibilities, you know, of his life. You know, he doesn't have to deliver that package to that beautiful farm girl, right? That ranch girl. And maybe he doesn't. You know, he smiles at the end. We think that's what he's going to do. But, you know, life is open in ways we can't appreciate because of our mental habits. And, you know, Zen requires us to go through a process of something like losing our bearings or having the rug pulled out from under us. And we go through this process again and again, and we become, you know, awakened people. And awakened people aren't people who have all the answers. They're people who aren't afraid of not having the answer. They're people who aren't afraid of being confused, right? Another way to put it is they don't take it personally, right? It's not personal. You know, it's also the case, however, that both of these teachers are giving a good answer, right? For example, Jianfeng says, "The blessed ones in the ten directions are on one road, the gate of Nirvana. Where is that road?" Jianfeng drew a line in the air with his staff and says, "It is here." You know, there is a kind of truth to that, right? But to experience what it means to be here, really be here, we have to go through this process of confusion. So, you know, if I might put it this way, here, right here, is not the most accessible thing. You know, when people read books on Zen, or there's a book I saw at the bookstore the other day called 365 Zen, and it was 365 little Zen slogans, and there was probably a slogan in there like, just be here now, right? And it's like, okay, I'll just be here now, great. But it's not easy for humans to just be here now. You know, when you think you're really here now, when it's easy to be here now, when you think that, you're a million miles from being really here, if that makes any sense. You know, this moment is not readily accessible to us. You know, it's in the same way, it's very difficult to be truly spontaneous. It's very difficult to be truly spontaneous because it's difficult to be truly open and trusting. So, you know, there's another koan that goes, what is Buddha? The koan is basically, ordinary mind is the way. See? What is the way? Ordinary mind is the way. And that's probably in that 365 Zen book, right? Ordinary mind. So somebody in the bookstore is having a cup of espresso and reading the book. Maybe the person will buy it, and maybe they'll put it back on the shelf. And they read, you know, ordinary mind is the way. It's like, yeah, my ordinary mind is the way. But actually, that mind is very difficult to find. The mind we normally inhabit isn't ordinary mind. The mind we normally inhabit is all of these cliches and all of these lessons we've learned, and very difficult. We're like, most of the time, we're like Tom Hanks before he was marooned on the island, right? We're just repeating what we've been told. We're just doing what we're supposed to do. We're living the life we were supposed to live. It's very difficult to be here now, you know. When you came here this morning and sat down on the cushion, you know, you're clearing away all of this stuff. You know, you're watching the breath, or you're calling Mu, or you're working with your koan. And it's like deconditioning the mind. You know, the mind gets to a place where it's silent or quieter. You know, and now it's possible to experience things in a new way, right? Now it's like deconditioning the mind, that you do this enough and you stay in that empty state long enough, and when you get off the cushion, it's possible to see things in a new way. But it takes a lot of work, and it takes a certain kind of humility, right, to admit that you have to do that work. You know, lots of people like the idea that ordinary mind is the way, because it's saying everything's okay just as you are. And Buddha, Zen says that too sometimes, everything. But being just what you are, being here now, is very difficult to achieve. You know, most of the time, we're in a world of our projections. We're in the world of our fantasies, you know. I was just reading a psychoanalyst, one of many, writing about our president. And the psychoanalyst is a very intelligent person. I thought her analysis was brilliant, actually. And she talked about how Trump's parents were very emotionally withholding parents, and very vindictive and punitive. And this is actually well known, how his father raised him and his mother. And this person was saying, you know, the way Trump coped with all of this was to basically create a kind of bubble around himself in which he was always in command, always capable, always winning, you know, always successful. And the psychoanalyst was saying he literally can't see when he's doing something, you know, stupid, or he can't believe that he's failing when he's failing. And, you know, her point was, he's not repressing this. He's not saying, uh-oh, I'm failing, I better have a different way of looking at this. His mental apparatus, his psychological defense mechanisms are so powerful, he can't hear criticism. It's not that he's shutting it out. You know, he can't hear it. So you know, Trump is an extreme example of somebody who, I doubt he will read a 365 Zen book, but he could read that. You know, ordinary mind is the way. And you know, or George Bush. You know, actually, George Bush used to say that he just trusted his instincts. It sounds like a Zen master, right? But ordinary mind is very difficult to achieve. We have to go through a lot of deconditioning. Karmic conditioning before we can be fully here. And so sometimes it's the unclear communication that is most liberating. You know, when I box you in, when I, you know, give you a koan that traps you or that makes you feel blocked, facing a wall, you know, nobody likes that feeling. Nobody likes to be marooned on an island. But that's often what it takes for people to wake up, to become liberated and free, right? You know, that the great Japanese Zen master Hakuin used to call he said, oh, those vile koans, right? Those koans are vile, you know. But he meant, you know, nobody likes to be trapped. Nobody likes to be marooned. But, you know, we go through that process again and again, and that's how we become liberated. A roundabout explanation is easy to understand. It imparts with one hand. A direct explanation is hard to understand. It opens up in all directions. I urge you not to use clear speech, for speech is clear, getting out is all the more difficult. If you don't believe me, let's try to bring this up. A monk asked John Fong, the blessed ones, the enlightened ones, in the 10 directions, the bodhisattvas, are on one road, the gate of nirvana. Where is that road? John Fong drew a line in the air with his staff and said, right here. And under certain circumstances, that could be a good answer. But the monk asked Yuen Men the same question. And Yuen Men, like Edo Roshi, says, the fan leaps up to the 33 heavens and hits the emperor of the gods on the nose. The carp of the eastern sea is hit with the stick and it rains buckets. Do you understand? Do you understand? So the monk who hears that is going to go, what the hell? Right? What the hell? I'm totally lost. The other first answer, the monk thinks, oh, I've got it. No problem, right? Still in chains. The second master gives him this, and he walks away thinking, what the hell? I have no idea. When people come into Dokusan and say, I have no idea what I'm doing, it's like music to my ears. It's like, ah, now liberation can happen. Starting in, it turns out he uses medicine for a dead horse. The reviving incense is about to cause you peril. So the incense that revives you almost has to kill you, basically. If all your life you squeeze out sweat through your body, only then will you believe he didn't spare his eyebrows. So look, another person, a philosopher named Plato, said, the beautiful is difficult. The beautiful is difficult. Enlightenment requires some effort. Waking up requires effort. Being a good person requires a lot of effort. You know, I'll stop in just a minute, but I was reading about Mr. Rogers, right? The man who produced shows for children. And they interviewed Mr. Rogers' wife. And the reporter said, how does it feel? How did it feel to be married to a saint? Because he's a very good man. If you read the things he says, they're so noble. And she said, he was not a saint. She said, don't you say that about him. She said, he worked hard to be a good person every day of his life. See? Now that's wisdom, right? That's wisdom. Right? Just to be a good person takes a lot of work. And to be awake takes a lot of work. You know, if you sweated a little bit on the cushion today, that's very good. That is, how do you get to be a Buddha? You have to sweat a lot on the cushion, actually. So please, everybody sweated a lot today. Please keep sweating. So important.